Welcome to your turn, Mike Causey. Delighted to have you with us. Got a really good show today, and I don't want to waste any time. We're going to be talking about sequestration, federal pay, domestic partner benefits, GSA, you name it. We're going to cover the waterfront. My first guest is Jackie Simon. She is Director of Public Policy for the American Federation of Government Employees and an economist by training. Jackie, are you there?
I am.
Hey, thank you very much for agreeing to come on. Wanted to hit you with two things and get right into it. Sequestration. Everybody's talking about it. Most people, myself included, I don't think have a very good understanding of it. What is it briefly, and what's the danger, if any?
Well, there's tremendous danger, certainly for federal employees. In 2011, Congress passed a law and called the Budget Control Act that created that super committee that was supposed to try to come up with deficit reduction in a way that, you know, balanced increased taxes with spending cuts. This was forced upon President Obama by the Congress in return for raising the debt ceiling. And there was a trigger in the law that that said that if the super committee failed to make a recommendation to the Congress, then these spending cuts would automatically go into effect starting in January 2013. Well, we all know that the super committee did not reach an agreement, so they didn't send a plan to the Congress to be voted on. And so here we are. You know, we had several months to sort of ignore it, but now as the clock is ticking, January 2013 doesn't seem so far away anymore. People are finally focused on what sequestration would actually mean. Half the cuts are to come out of the Department of Defense, and the other half from domestic discretionary spending. There are certain areas of spending that are off limits, and that, you know, that's mandatory spending. Sometimes people call it entitlement, Social Security benefits, that sort of thing. And the Department of Veterans Affairs is pretty much off limits. And so we're spreading, you know, massive spending cuts across these agencies in ways that have yet to be specified.
So federal retirement wouldn't be an issue.
No.
Correct, but federal jobs could be, huh?
Absolutely. And I think last week Stephen Fuller, which probably most of the listeners have heard of, he's a somebody who's often quoted in the press studying the impact of any kind of tax and budget policy on the Washington metropolitan area's economy. But he put out an estimate of the likely economic impact of sequestration on DOD and non-DOD agencies. And, you know, he makes some assumptions that I wouldn't make. He was being paid by contractors, by defense contractors.
Right.
So he has, you know, put out a set of estimates that assume an enormous portion of the budget cuts would fall on contractors. From our perspective, we think that's highly unlikely. We've been told, unfortunately and inaccurately, by many politicians and some, you know, some other advocates, that the contractors, you know, are at least going to argue that they're legally exempt. Hello?
Oh. Are you there? Yeah.
You're under my end.
We're sorry. Your call.
They are
sorry. Complete.
Oh, well, Jackie, if you can speak on.
Anyway,
they're saying that the cost of terminating contracts or, you know, failing to renew or any of that kind of thing would be higher than continuing the contracts. And so we're looking for a scenario where the contractors are basically protected,
right,
and that most or all of the sequestration cuts fall on federal employees. Now, Fuller's study talks about 277,000 federal jobs eliminated. That's a pretty big number for somebody who's arguing that most of the cuts are going to fall on contractors. What we foresee is, you know, of course, that's one possible scenario. But another possible scenario is furloughs and RIFs that will be, you know, something like, you know, every federal employee will not come to work, to, you know, will be
staggered,
furloughed. you know, a couple days a week.
Yeah. And they, of course, they could solve this, correct? It's still time.
Of course.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, but, you know, the sort of another horrible scenario is if they avert this, but do so by saying, okay, fine, we won't do the sequestration, but we're going to gut Social Security. We're going to raise the retirement age on Social Security and change the formula for inflation adjustment. Of course, none of these things has anything to do with creating more jobs, which is, like, you know, sort of most important, should be the most important thing. But there's a, you know, there's an agenda here, and it's a chess game, and at least some members of Congress are going to exercise their power in a very clever and damaging way, and they'll use this leverage because nobody wants sequestration. The president doesn't want sequestration. Congress doesn't want sequestration. Department of Defense and the contractors don't want it. So guess what?
Social Security. This is really Congress at its best. Jackie, I know there's another subject that's near and dear to your heart, and that is this new government accountability study on it was taking a look at the different groups who've compared federal pay, and depending on their politics and their view of government, we know for a fact, based on these studies, that government workers are either overpaid by 58% or are underpaid by 28%. I mean, that's quite a gap.
Yeah, you know, GAO was always, you know, very, very careful to not say anything that sounds remotely political. And so they, you know, tried to be as objective as possible in merely describing these studies. But the studies that come out of Cato and the American Enterprise Institute and Heritage and, unfortunately, CBO, all used a version of what is called in the economics profession the human capital approach. And that looks at pay by demographic characteristic. Now, of course, the federal government does not set pay based on your gender or your race or even your level of education. It sets the pay on the basis of the job duties to which you're assigned. And so jobs are classified, and a salary is an attribute of the job, not the individual. So it doesn't really matter what the race or age or gender or pedigree of the person holding the job is. It's, here's the job. If you can perform it adequately, this is what the salary is associated with that job. That's, of course, how it should be. It should be that way in the private sector, too, in an ideal world. But, you know, we know there's a lot of discrimination that goes on in the private sector. And so when you look at these human capital models, what you find is big, big gaps, for example, in what the federal government pays African-Americans and what the private sector pays African-Americans with similar levels of education or something like that, right? So if there's discrimination in the private sector and there's not in the federal government, well, the result of your study is that the federal government's overpaying.
Yeah, well,
that's what's really insidious about these human capital studies. GAO's too polite to say that.
Well, the thing that, you know, always intrigues me about it is some people, I mean, even if they're being honest, seem to assume that the government is still an army of clerks in green eye shades, when in fact it's, in the last 20 years, it is professionalized to the point where I don't even know if there are secretaries anymore, if there are, or clerk stenos, that computers have changed things, the nature of the government has changed things, and as I always say, the government does not do retail. There is nothing equivalent to Walmart in the federal government.
Well, it's all true, and all of that data is in the studies that the right-wing think tanks did, and of course they're inappropriate sources of comparison. Of course, you know, when they do the when they do the comparisons on benefits, as you point out, when they're looking at averages or medians in the private sector, they're including employers like Walmart who provide no retirement benefit and no health insurance. So, of course, the federal government's going to look too generous compared to a firm that provides nothing. So, you know, it's another way that it's skewed. But it's just, you know, these kind of these kind of models are, you know, very, very inappropriate for assessing the adequacy of pay or the appropriateness of pay or comparability of pay. I mean, even the education measure, which you think might be objective, certainly isn't objective. I mean, they, you know, in a human capital model, 4 years a 4-year degree from any institution is in that model should be valued at the same level as, you know, a biochemistry degree from MIT. And, you know, we all know that those two degrees aren't worth the same thing. But if and the government is much more likely to hire somebody with a degree in biochemistry, maybe not from MIT, but
yeah.
You know, then I don't know. I'm not going to insult anybody by using a certain degree as a point of comparison. But there are plenty of 4-year degrees that do not command as much pay in the market as degrees in scientific fields and that kind of thing. And the federal government, of course, employs a lot of engineers and scientists.
Well, probably never going to change anybody's mind. It's made up that either feds are underpaid or overpaid. Talking about the future, what is the outlook for a pay raise or a pay freeze in 2013?
Well, it's very, very hard to imagine, and I think the answer is probably going to depend at least in part on the outcome of the election. The Obama administration has you know, been pretty firm in its stance. Its proposal for a 0.5% raise. And, of course, that's, you know, extremely modest by any standard. At least it breaks the freeze. And, there are Republicans in Congress have been just as adamant, if not more adamant, that they'd like to see a pay cut. And if not not a pay cut, then just another 3 years of freeze.
Well, so, I keep reading things about Congress is silent on the federal pay issue. I'm looking at a story here, House Committee silence on 2013
right.
pay raise. What does that mean? Does that mean if they do nothing, if Congress does nothing, that half percentage point pay raise will go into effect automatically?
Possibly. There could be instructions that that agencies would merely would have to absorb that 0.5% pay increase, and that would be an alternative pay raise that the president could propose under the law if Congress never addresses it.
So the difference is he would have to propose it and agencies would have to absorb it as opposed to Congress and the administration appropriating funds to pay for it.
Right. If Congress never legislates on the issue, then the alternative to what FEPCA would, what would be implemented under FEPCA would have to be proposed by the administration.
Okay, because we had a discussion here at Federal News Radio, and some people thought it was an automatic thing, and I thought, no, somebody has to push a button or do something.
Well, what's automatic, unless Congress or the president overrides what's automatic, would be the raises, full comparability raises that are called for under the law. And unfortunately,
that's not going to happen.
Federal employees to get what they're entitled to under the law.
Yeah, that's not going to happen. Well, Jackie, listen, I really appreciate you taking time. I know you have to go to another meeting, but we'll talk later on this and see how the sequestration goes. Thank you, Jackie Simon.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. We'll take a short break here, and we'll be right back talking with Federal Timesman Steve Losey and Sean Riley.
And I can just read on the plane without any problem. Like now, when I'm on the airplane and somebody has a Kindle, they either have to turn on the light because a Kindle doesn't have any light built into it, or they also have these little small lights that clamp onto the side of the Kindle that lights it up because the Kindle is not a backlit screen. On the other hand, when I go to the swimming pool and there's bright sunlight, I cannot use the iPad.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM. Rock that fanny pack, wearing those khakis last.
Kevin, yeah? What are you doing?
Hi, just,
hey, oh, that's okay.
We need to get you well,
it livens things up.
You were listening to that song in my Kia Optima with the UVO infotainment.
Yeah, Steve. Yeah.
Radio, you'd hear all the lyrics with crystal clear digital sound quality. Plus the artist and song title even display on my UVO screen.
Okay.
Then let's go for a ride.
Sure, yeah.
The fanny pack song comes on.
Voice activated UVO infotainment system and
Steve,
radio
Steve
now available in the Kia Optima.
Steve should
Life's
be
big decisions require some research. You get comparison reports before you buy a car. You hire an inspector when buying a house.
Okay, good.
You might even look
and
up someone online.
And then Sean will be have the appearance of feeling
but
he's been
on the But when you go to pick your primary care physician, sometimes you only get a name and number. That hardly seems fair. After all, the only person who has more influence on your health is you. It's different at Kaiser Permanente. All our doctors are listed online with information that paints a picture of who they are. So you know you're picking a doctor who is right for you. Right for your family, and someone you can email. Oh, here's one for Dr. Amy Benoulis, who went to Northwestern. Dr. Lindsay Strickland is interested in chronic disease management and is accepting new patients. Bingo! Become a member, and no matter whom you choose, you get a true advocate for your health. So log on to kp.org/doctor and check us out. It could be the beginning of a healthy relationship. Kaiser Permanente. Thrive.
Kaiser Foundation Health Plan of the Mid-Atlantic States Incorporated, 2101 East Jefferson Street, Rockville, Maryland, 20852.
Opportunities in restructuring. How have agencies been able to increase efficiency, optimize mission execution, and rethink processes? Tune in to Reorganization and Restructuring in Government, presented by Deloitte. Hear Max Steyer, President and CEO, Partnership for Public Service. Jim Bradley, Assistant Public Printer, Government Printing Office. Rhea Sue, Assistant Secretary for Policy, Budget, and Management, Interior Department. And John Powers, Principal, Deloitte Consulting. Reorganization and Restructuring in Government, presented by Deloitte. Thursday at noon on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Wondering how to meet the Cloud First or Shared First initiatives? Hi, I'm Amy Rock with the federal sector of VCE. VCE VBlock systems tightly integrate and pre-test technology from cloud leaders Cisco, EMC, and VMware to get you to the cloud faster, so you can share services and information and easily provision resources while safeguarding proprietary applications and data.
Make VCE your first choice for Cloud First. To learn more, visit vce.com/federal.
Accenture. High performance delivered. It's how we help clients take on their most complex challenges. We helped process $650 billion in benefit payments for U.S. federal organizations. And we helped eliminate $348 million in U.S. federal fleet, inventory, and freight costs. With unmatched capabilities across defense, public safety, and civilian, Accenture consistently delivers results at speed. Accenture. High performance delivered. To learn more, visit Accenture.com/federal.
Welcome to today's lottery drawing. And today's winning numbers are not yours, not yours, and another number that's not yours. And the final number is not yours.
When it comes to having money, don't rely on luck. Brew your own coffee at home instead of buying that latte. Brown bag it to work instead of ordering in. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas on how to save.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
Mike Causey, welcome back to your turn. I'm going to be talking with Stephen Losey and Sean Riley from the Federal Times. Steve, you're just coming off vacation, right? Steve, are you there? Maybe he's still on vacation. We're going to dial up Steve Losey again here. Meantime, the subject is going to be, well, a couple of things. We're going to get his opinion on the federal pay situation. And also the stories that have broken this week about the offering of health coverage to the children of same-sex domestic partners, and also the fact that the Federal Thrift Savings Plan is getting active in collecting child support through it. This was mandated a couple of years ago, but there hasn't been much action in it, but they have signed a letter of agreement with the Department of Health and Human Services in order to get federal workers involved in this, and they've started collecting quite a bit of money. And also, I'm confused about the situation with the children of same-sex partners getting health coverage, because it was my understanding that the government does not allow same-sex partners to have health insurance, only the federal member. But we're going to be finding out about that, and also talk about the federal pay situation. Jackie Simon from the American Federation of Government Employees, she's director of public policy, and she's an economist. And Jackie said that that some proactive things have to take place before federal workers were to get any kind of pay raise. The White House, as you probably recall, has proposed a half a percentage point pay increase for federal workers that would be effective in January 2013. The Congress, particularly the House, has been moving toward an extension of the federal pay freeze. Some want to extend it for a year, some for two, some for as much as 5 years, and that's on the back burner. But the fact is that this 0.5% pay raise that President Obama has proposed is not a done deal. It's not automatic. He would have to push some buttons and get some whistles going, and then it would be put into effect as something that federal agencies would have to absorb. So they would have to absorb really literally billions of dollars in extra expenses to them rather than having the Congress appropriate it, which is the normal way these things are done. So we're going to be getting on that and talk with I think we're getting Steve Losey back on the line right now. Steve, are you there? Hey, Steve, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, that was a long vacation. I was kidding you at the beginning of the vacation. I
thought,
listen, glad to have you. Got a couple of interesting stories this week. Start off with the same-sex partners getting health coverage. Now, my understanding, correct me if I'm wrong, is that they do not get health coverage now, but that they're going to extend it to children?
Yeah, here's the issue of health coverage for gay and lesbian feds families is kind of a weird thing. The Obama administration, their policy is to try to extend as much benefits as possible, as they legally can, to the families of gay and lesbian federal employees. They've already extended things like eligibility for long-term care coverage for same-sex partners of gay and lesbian feds, made their partners and their partners' children eligible for child care subsidies and services and credit union membership and things like that. But the big one that gay and lesbian feds really want, unsurprisingly, is access to federal employees' health benefits program. Now, the Obama administration says they want to extend that, but they're prohibited from doing so by the Defense of Marriage Act. However, last Friday, the Office of Personnel Management announced that they were going to start defining the children of a gay or lesbian feds, same-sex domestic partner or spouse, as a stepchild, which would make them eligible for FEHBP and the federal vision and dental program.
So they would define them as a stepchild rather than as a natural child, if you will, or an adopted child.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, clearly that could work, but it's just a matter of words. It would seem that in addition, they're citing the Defense of Marriage Act as the thing that's blocking them. But I thought that Congress also had to approve significant major changes in the federal employee health benefits program.
They do and they don't.
Uh-huh.
The Obama administration has been kind of going through the regulations with a fine-tooth comb to see what they can change without Congress acting, just by changes to regulations, which they already have the power for. On the healthcare front, there was an interesting development a couple of months ago. There was a lesbian federal employee in California whose name is Karen Galinsky, who has been suing the Office of Personnel Management to get coverage for her wife. She is legally married to a woman in California.
Mm-hmm.
And the court ruled that she should get her wife should get health care benefits. Now, the Obama administration, the Justice Department looked at it and said, okay, the court said we have to give this woman's wife benefits, but that's it. So even though she's the only same-sex spouse in the federal government getting health care benefits, which is kind of an unusual situation, especially for OPM Director John Barry, who is an openly gay man who has said that he really wants to get gay and lesbian federal employees benefits, but he says their hands are tied by justice's reading of the court decision.
So of all of the, and I think you estimated one of the stories that there were 34,000 gay and lesbian workers who are in domestic partnerships, legally married in their states and whatnot. But does this mean that there's only one spouse of a, in this case, a gay woman, who only one spouse is getting federal health insurance coverage now, and that's because of a specific court decision?
That's right.
Very interesting. Very interesting. We didn't talk about things like this 10 years ago.
Yeah. No, it's a different world.
Yeah, it is. Listen, you had an interesting piece about the thrift savings plan. It says gets active in collecting owed child support. And it hadn't even occurred to me that this was an issue. But tell us about that.
Yeah, the thrift savings plan has, from the start, been required to had the power and been required to help collect unpaid child support when federal employees fall behind in their payments. But for one reason or another, they've never really done that a whole lot until recent years. But in 2010, HHS's, the Health and Human Services Office of Child Support Enforcement, reached out to TSP and said, hey, can you help us out? And they struck a deal to share data and help collect unpaid child support. Now, in previous years, it almost never happened. Usually zero, maybe one, maybe two, just not very many. You could count them on one hand, practically. But since then, it's kind of taken off. So far this year, TSP is processing about 1,100 child support court orders per month. So there's about 35,000 TSP participants that are behind in their child support payments right now, according to the Thrift Savings Plan. So I expect that as the TSP gets more used to the process and gets better at figuring out where these feds who are in arrears on their child support are, I expect there's going to be a lot more than the 1,100 per month.
I would think this could get very tricky. I understand the concept of garnishment. Somebody comes after my salary, they can attach some or in some cases maybe almost all of it, and that's salary. But where does the TSP money come from? Is this investments that people have made, or is this from the contributions they're making?
Yeah, I'm not really sure exactly which pot of money the garnishments come out of.
I would think that maybe it's only to it could only be to people who are retired and who are getting payments.
Yeah, it's entirely possible. You know, they could be taking money out of their accounts. They could be taking money from the monthly contributions, and instead of that money going into the TSP accounts, it gets diverted to cover their child support payments. I'm not really sure about that.
Yeah, very tricky. I mean, obviously the numbers are there, but we don't know where it's coming from. Hey, while you were away, the GSA situation reared its ugly head again. Are you up to speed on that?
Yeah. Boy, the GSA just can't catch a break, it seems. The latest revelation was a one-day performance award ceremony in 2010 that cost more than $250,000. And the thing about these GSA scandals that keep popping up is they have these juicy, colorful details about, you know, what the money was, you know, in critics' minds, what the money was wasted on.
Oh, excuse me. I know one of those very juicy ones. Let me ask you this after a very short break here on WFED 1500.
Journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is Geico anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that Geico isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how Geico actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, Geico saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
This is an important message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. In hot weather, power failures can be deadly. When the heat is on but the power is out, check on neighbors, relatives, and others at risk, including the elderly and young children. To keep yourself and loved ones cool, drink plenty of non-alcoholic fluids, reduce activities, take cool showers or baths, wear light-colored clothing, and know where to go for emergency relief.
It's about smiles. It's about laughter. It's about going out and making a difference in the life of a child. You don't have to get mad. You just have to go mad. GoMad2011.com is a website dedicated to supporting the Make-A-Wish Foundation. At GoMad, our mission is simple, to go out and make a difference. So how can you help? Visit the Wish Wall on GoMad2011.com and make a contribution today. Or find out how you can donate with a simple text message. Do it now so that we can continue to touch the lives of children with life-threatening conditions by granting their wishes.
Hi, this is Wayne Zell, host of Blueprint for Wealth, every Saturday here on 1500 AM at 10 AM. Please join me this week for my special guest, David Adelman, founder and CEO of Real Tributes, the premier producer of personal history films. Blueprint for Wealth is brought to you by Odin Feldman and Pittleman, a law firm located in Fairfax, moving to Reston. Visit us on the web at ofplaw.com.
Hi, everybody. It's David and Nikki Nellis for Foodie and the Beast, the D.C. area's one and only food and wine variety show. Tune in next Sunday and every Sunday at 11 right here on 1500 and 820 a.m. to hear the latest from the food and wine scene. We've got celebrity chefs, sommeliers, winemakers, and more all here to tell you about the inside skinny that you won't find anywhere else. That's Foodie and the Beast this Sunday at 11.
Concerned about your health? Then be sure to catch the groundbreaking radio show, Essentials of Healthy Living, brought to you by Village Green Apothecary. Join hosts Dana Lake and Kevin Passero as they bring you the latest news about traditional and alternative medicine, nutrition, dietary supplements, herbal remedies, and more. Tune in every Sunday at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Listen to past shows and discover other healthy living resources at myvillagegreen.com. Visit Village Green Apothecary in Bethesda at 5415 West Cedar Lane.
Engineers say a new artificial fingertip allows robots to sense textures even better than you can. The robotic finger called BioTac mimics a human's with a bone-like core that's bathed in a blood-like salt water encased in a silicone skin that even has fingerprints. It turns out
they're not just there for the FBI.
Gerald Loeb, a bioengineering professor at the University of Southern California, says when rubbed on a surface, the robotic fingerprints create vibrations which can be detected in the core, along with things like temperature. Unlike human fingers, though, the robotic skin itself has no sensors.
We have to put all our sensors in the core to get them out of harm's way and make the skin replaceable when it wears out.
Loeb says the real key is a computer algorithm that interprets all those signals and directs any follow-up touching. He says we shouldn't be surprised that it distinguishes textures better than people do.
When you engineer a machine, you can make one thing optimal.
With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Hey, welcome back to Your Turn. Thanks for sticking around. Talking with Stephen Losey from the Federal Times. We were just getting to the juicy stuff, the GSA, the latest GSA flare-up. And, you know, I should say that I know you've talked with GSA people, as I have. The few that I have talked to on this subject, they are sick, they are angry, they are embarrassed by it. They had nothing to do with it, but they think it gives them and all federal workers a black eye.
Yeah, what is kind of salt in the wound is that it seems to never end. You know, back in April, the big bomb that went off that kind of cost former Administrator Martha Johnson and several other leaders their job was the Western Regions Conference in Las Vegas. It cost more than $823,000. It had clowns. It had mind readers. It had receptions with lavish food and booze, entertainment. And it was a very parodyable, if that's a word, example of what critics say is government waste.
Well, this one you were talking about just a minute ago, the one-day conference in 2010, mm-hmm. I think it was in Crystal City or over in the Washington area, cost $250,000 one day, and you were talking about some of the juicy things that popped out of it. Would drumsticks be one?
Yep, $21,000 for 4,000 drumsticks, almost 21,000, that is. $28,000 for 4,000 picture frames, almost $7,700 for reception with a guitarist and violinist. And, you know, Jeff Denham, a congressman from California, who's been one of the leading critics, he got off the line about instead of clowns and mind readers, we've got violinists and guitarists. GSA has really classed up their act.
Isn't that frightening? Well, you know, this is the kind of thing. There used to be a rule in Congress, members don't do anything that you wouldn't want to see on the front page of the Washington Post or on 60 Minutes. And it may well be that this sort of thing has gone on in GSA for years. Huh?
Yeah, and there are critics in the House that are saying that this is a sign, Denham, for one, that's saying that this is a sign that there's just a systemic problem deep-rooted in GSA. And, you know, it's also casting aspersions on the rest of the government because some of these GSA critics are saying, well, that's just what we know about. I'm sure the same kind of thing is going on at a lot of other agencies. It doesn't look good for anybody.
It seems to me that GSA is acting as a heat shield and a deflector for other agencies. You know this has probably happened in other places, over-the-top parties.
Yeah, probably, but you know that heat shield can only last for so long.
Well, that's right. I mean, and the Secret Service must be very glad for GSA about now because it deflected. But, you know, today in the Washington Post, and we have a story and you have it too, these new revelations about the Federal Aviation Administration and the fact that it has a policy some people are challenging. It's almost like confession, if you will, and that is if you admit to sleeping on the job or watching TV or playing a game when you were supposed to be doing air traffic controller duties, you're off the hook.
Yeah, it's things like that have people, you know, questioning the ability of the federal government to police itself, basically.
Yeah, well, in the case of the FAA, there have been stories in the not too distant past about controllers sleeping on the job, one controller station where the controller was sleeping on the job, or where they took turns looking out for each other. This is, should there be a crash for whatever reason, this is going to be a very difficult thing to deal with.
Yeah, and It will look bad. And what really gets under a lot of federal employee skin about this kind of thing is that, you know, the vast majority of federal employees aren't falling asleep or playing video games on the job or whatever. The vast majority of federal employees are doing their job and doing their job well. But it's kind of the one bad apple theory that when, you know, someone falls asleep when they should be directing planes, or someone blows almost, more than $800,000 on a conference, it kind of allows critics of the federal workforce, and there's a lot of them these days, to tar everybody with the same brush.
Well, a lot of professions and trades have the same problem we do in the journalism and the media field. Whenever they catch somebody plagiarizing or making up stories, lying, it tars us all, and people say, I knew it all along.
They're all making everything up.
Yeah. OPM and the processing backlog, how's that going?
That is showing some signs of progress. The Office of Personnel Management released their latest numbers a couple of weeks ago, and they're showing progress. Now, this is something that's been a long-standing problem for OPM. For decades, it's taken them months, maybe 6 months or more, to process retirees pension claims, and in the meantime they pay those retirees an interim payment. Sometimes it's half, sometimes it's less. OPM says it's more. Reports vary. Back in January, the case backlog in pension claims was about 61,000 unprocessed cases. Back in last month in June, they brought it down to 48,000. So that's progress. But while the OPM should be lauded for that, it's worth noting that $48,000 case backlog is still a lot bigger than it was back in October 2010 when John Berry said that he was going to tackle that problem. It was 38,000 cases back then.
All right.
So progress, but there's still a long way to go.
Yeah, and with the buyouts and whatnot. Steve, thanks very much for being with us, and we'll take a break here and be right back.
Governments at all levels are operating in an era of fiscal austerity. Though revenues may be falling, the demand for critical services continue. Join host Michael Keegan as he welcomes Seth Diamond, Commissioner of New York City Department of Homeless Services, as they discuss New York's response to the challenge of homelessness. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.
The leader in informational seminars on federal benefits, financial, and retirement planning. NITP was established in 1984 and is 100% devoted to federal planning seminars. The mission is to educate federal employees and enable them to make fully informed decisions regarding their financial futures and retirement options. Through a variety of teaching platforms and seminars, NITP has the experience to help with your planning needs. Visit NITPinc.com. That's NITPinc.com for information.
The Workforce Mobility Initiative is transforming the federal workplace. But what's the most efficient, cost-effective way to implement it? Hi, I'm Amy Rock with the federal sector of VCE. VCE VBlock systems are optimized for applications such as desktop virtualization and cloud services, so you can ensure that employees and customers get what they need whenever and wherever.
Work better and smarter with VCE VBlock systems. To learn more, visit vce.com/federal. That's vce.com/federal.
I'm Beyonce with an important message about hunger in America. Did you know 1 in 8 people struggle with hunger? Over 12 million children live in homes where there isn't always enough food. Food banks are experiencing more demand than ever. Show Your Helping Hand is a nationwide campaign with the goal of helping Feeding America deliver millions of meals to local food banks. Please join me in showing a helping hand to fight hunger. More information is available at showyourhelpinghand.com.
It probably set back the program for a couple of years. But this demonstrated that cyber weapons could physically destroy critical infrastructure. Now, the problem is we have SCADA devices attaching all of the infrastructure we have in the U.S. Our dams, our electrical power grid, everything is remotely controlled by the Internet. And there are always a SCADA device in between the Internet connection and what the device is doing.
Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on 1500 AM.
Congratulations on landing the job. I'm really excited for you.
Thanks. How's your search going?
Job market's tight. I mean, I can barely get an interview. Yeah. And I've got student loans to deal with. You're lucky, you know. The National Guard paid your loans off.
Luck? The Guard was a smart decision, one you can still make.
The National Guard Student Loan Repayment Program can pay up to $50,000 of your existing student loans. Get the details at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the D.C. National Guard, aired by the Maryland, D.C. Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to GEICO.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
GovEvents.com is your one-stop for government and military events worldwide. With hundreds of event organizers posting their government and military-related conferences, trade shows, expos, webcasts, and more, you'll save time and energy using GovEvents to find events to attend, exhibit, or sponsor. Search for government and military events by date, location, keyword, organizer, or focus. It's free, so join today. GovEvents.com. That's GovEvents.com.
This is Mark Amtower. For 27 years, I've advised hundreds of large and small contractors on the best marketing tactics to reach key government buyers and influencers. Collectively, my clients have made billions of dollars by maximizing the value of their contracts. If you need to maximize the value of your GSA schedule, GWAC, or IDIQ, or you need to raise your overall visibility in the government market, we need to talk. Make certain your marketing budget pays major dividends. Contact me at federaldirect.net.
Causey. Welcome back to your turn. We'll be talking with Sean Riley. He's a senior writer with the Federal Times. Sean, are you there?
I'm here.
Hey, thank you for being around. And when we talk about things government, the two-ton elephant in the room is always the U.S. Postal Service, second largest agency, and even though it's attempting to downsize like mad, it is still the second largest federal agency. What's going on there?
Well, they're heading to a default next week on a $5.5 billion legally required prepayment into the retiree health care fund. I checked this morning. Really, nothing's changed. There doesn't seem to be any prospect of congressional action to head it off, so it looks like they missed the payment and very likely miss a similar size payment that's due at the end of September.
What does that mean? I mean, $5.5 billion, I can't get my head around numbers like that, but they owe $5.5 billion to pre-fund their retirement plan, even though other federal agencies are not required to do this, and then they're going to have to turn around in September and kick in another $5.5 billion. What happens if they default? I mean, who do they default to?
Oh, they default to the government. This is an account that's, you know, administered by OPM.
Mm-hmm.
This is not the first time this situation has arisen. And 2 years ago, the Congressional Research Service did a report saying that, you know, no one knows what the consequences would be, and that's kind of where we still are at today. I mean, there's no indication that it would, again, because it's an intergovernmental transfer, essentially, that it would do any damage to the, you know, the government's credit rating as a whole, but it would be a black eye for the Postal Service. And, you know, there is some concern that it could, you know, add to the sense of crisis surrounding the Postal Service and lead some of its customers, you know, mailers, et cetera, to consider other options.
But the CRS says they really don't know what would happen.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, this seems, as far as I can tell, this is a first. It's unprecedented, at least, any default of this size.
If it were a less amount, OPM might garnish you the wages of the Postmaster General. But you're talking about $11 billion here in two payments.
Yeah, it's going to be hard to, I think you could be hard to shake that amount of change out of the PMG's pockets.
Now, I noticed an op-ed piece in the Washington Post last week by the president of the National Association of Letter Carriers saying that, in fact, the Postal Service is in good shape, that when you set aside all of these demands that are put on it to make these payments, other federal agencies are not required to do, but when you take that out of the equation, the Postal Service is doing all right.
Well, it would certainly be doing better if it didn't have to make this prepayment for retiree health care, but you know, you talk to postal executives and the Postmaster General on down, and they say, look, you know, our mail volume has declined by 25% in the last few years. Workforce is down as well. Given the continuing popularity of, like, you know, email options, and continuing migration of their business, particularly the first-class mail volume business, which really pays the bills for them, they say, you know, long-term, they've got, it's not just the retiree health care premium. They have some difficult structural issues they've got to deal with. And while they certainly want to be rid of this requirement to make this prepayment, there are a lot of other things they're looking for that they see are necessary for them to regain profitability.
Do any seers, long thinkers out there, think there is a future for the Postal Service other than as a narrow, going back to being subsidized operation?
I think they're beginning to explore that. You know, a couple months ago, they appointed essentially a chief digital officer, somebody who was supposed to look at options, you know, other options that they might have to grow their business in the digital age, you know, via the Internet. One of those would be, that's been suggested, I think, by the IG, has been to essentially issue, be a kind of verification service that businesses and people operating in the Internet are who they say they are. I think this is something that's been done in other countries. But there is some sort of future foreseen for it. It's certainly doing well. You know, its packaged business is showing growth, but it's going to be a very different organization 10, 15 years from now than it is at present.
Well, I think one thing we forget, those of us still use the mail, and I do quite a bit. I was in Mexico City in March, mm-hmm. and I mailed a group of friends, including myself, a postcard saying, you know, I'm at the pyramids, I'm doing this, I'm going up the Grand Boulevard, and my memo to myself was to come back and do this again. None of those cards have been delivered. That was March.
Oh, my God.
I was in Bermuda in late June, and again, did the same thing, mailed some cards to friends and relatives, including to myself. They have not been delivered. as yet. So we're always knocking the Postal Service, and it's the butt of the jokes and the dog bites mailman. But the Postal Service is pretty darn good, isn't it?
Yeah, and actually I think overall they'd say they're getting better, at least when it comes to first class mail delivery. You know, they monitor their performance pretty closely, and overall it's been very good. You know, the thing is, though, now, again, with the decline in first-class mail volume, they're looking at, they're proceeding with essentially weakening their first-class delivery standards. You know, so a lot of mail now would be delivered overnight, will be supposed to be delivered overnight when they take a day or two longer. Overall, it's for all the knocks it takes, it does very well.
People are always looking at other countries. Germany and Switzerland come to mind. They're much smaller, you know, the ones the size of Oregon. The other is considerably smaller than that. Have any of them changed their postal services? Do they do it a different way?
I think they have. And this is not something an area I'm an expert on, but I think there have been some countries that have moved towards privatization. And interestingly, there's the former White House budget director, President Obama, the first director, Peter Orszag, is out with a column today, I think, on for Bloomberg, saying essentially the postal service should be privatized. But then you run into issues. I mean, as you noted, the United States is a very large country, and it has a lot of very rural areas that no private company presumably is going to serve or could make money serving, and that has to be done by some kind of public entity.
Yeah, the no private company is going to carry a letter from Camden, South Carolina to Honolulu, Hawaii for 44 cents.
Exactly. One argument for privatizing it would be to get it out from under the thumb of Congress, which is, almost everyone would agree, is a source of a lot of its problems. But how to do that and how to maintain some kind of universal service is a very thorny question.
Very quickly, I know you've been looking at the defense IT situation. What's going on there?
Well, this is a huge ongoing effort that goes back to the 90s, where the Defense Department is trying to replace hundreds of what they call legacy computer systems, and these govern things like financial management, logistics management, payroll, with what they call enterprise resource planning systems, or ERPs for short. And these are very complex systems, and the idea is essentially it would integrate a lot of functions are now being carried out by by a bunch of different programs or systems. The problem is, as often happens in DOD, a lot of these programs have gone way over budget or the projected budget and are way behind schedule. And this issue has assumed added urgency because, as you know, DOD is under a congressional requirement to produce a fully auditable set of books by the end of fiscal 2017, in September 2017. And there was an Inspector General report out a week or so ago saying this, you know, there are problems with these development of these ERPs could get in the way of Defense Department's meeting that requirement.
Good deal. Yeah, I'm just fantasizing here while we're talking about it. We're talking about the Postal Service earlier. I think our respective employers should send us on an expensive tour of Europe and to look at European postal systems and come back and write extensive reports.
I think it's a national necessity.
Very good. Well, I know the public's clamoring for it. Listen, Sean Riley, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks, Stephen Lose and Jackie Simon. Remember, our shows are archived on our homepage, so you can dial them up and listen anytime at your leisure or pass them on to a friend. We hope you do. Otherwise, we'll see you next week. Have a good week.